So I'm going to tell you about two different works that I've done during my PhD. One's a collaboration with Wasim Bakker's lab, the Cold Atoms lab here at Princeton, and the other's theory work, or purely theoretical work. And the thing that ties them together is that both the systems that I'm going to talk about have some form of either emergent or microscopic dipole moment conservation. And what I mean here by dipole moment, it has nothing to do with, you know, dipoles in the system being the microscopic degree of freedom or anything. I really just mean, you know, you have a system that can conserve charge. The conservation of charge is the zeroth the zeroth moment of the charge distribution, and the conservation of the dipole moment is the first moment of the distribution, or you can just think of it as the center of mass of the charge. Okay, so we're talking about systems that have an emergent or microscopic center of mass conservation, essentially. Okay, so first I just want to put these works into context within the field that I work in. So the work that I do is concentrated on the dynamics of highly excited quantum antibody systems. So if you think of a spin chain that interacts, and you think of its Hamiltonian, you know, it has some corresponding many body spectrum, which I have a little cartoon of on the right. And a lot of condensed matter physics is done, you know, down here concerning, you know, ground states or very cold systems. But what I'm talking about and interested in are universal aspects of the dynamics of systems that are occupying these highly excited energy levels. And so sometimes people call it infinite temperature. So I, you know, work on trying to find universal aspects of those dynamics, which often means universal aspects of those systems' approach to their eventual thermal equilibrium, and also exceptions to that approach to thermal equilibrium. So, for instance, many body localized systems, you know, don't ever thermalize, and understanding that mechanism is of interest to me. Also, since I just mentioned, you know, dynamical phases that thermalize and ones that don't, there are phase transitions between them, and that's also of interest to me. So any of these topics I'm interested in talking about really anytime. Okay, so but today I'm going to talk about two different systems. The first one I'll talk about is what we call a tilted Fermi-Hubbard system. So it's a Fermi-Hubbard, Cold Atoms Fermi-Hubbard system on a 2D square lattice. And by tilt, what we really mean is just a linear potential or a strong constant force on the particles. And what we found was that you can get into a new hydrodynamic regime of this system. And I'll explain what's going on in that new regime. And in that regime, there's an emergent dipole moment conservation of the charge in the system. And that leads to subdiffusive thermalization. So slower than the regular diffusion that you would think would happen in a lattice system. Then the second system I'm going to talk about is a kinetically constrained circuit model. So I'm drawing it on the right here, where you have some 1D lattice of sites. The sites can have some number of particles on them. And, you know, the dynamics are induced by, you know, some random circuits that have you know, a microscopic charge and dipole moment conservation. And I'll show that also leads to subdiffusion and also a phase transition from a thermalizing phase to a non-thermalizing phase. Okay, so part one, the tilted Fermi-Hubbard system, was done in collaboration with Wasim Bakker's lab on the top row, and also with my advisor, David Hughes. So the Bakker lab did the experimental half of this work, and David and I did the theory. Okay, so good. So the system is, you can consider it to be isolated. So it's not open. It's on a 2D lattice, and it realizes, they realize in their lab, the cold atom Fermi-Hubbard system. So I'm showing the Hamiltonian for a Fermi-Hubbard model on the bottom here. The atoms are, you know, confined to the first band of the lattice. So it really is just this tight binding, you know, single orbital system. And then we add a strong external linear potential or tilt along one of the principal directions of this square lattice. So the tilt is aligned with one of the lattice directions. And I'm talking about just, you know, generically the system is half filled, spin balance, you know, those are not special aspects of what I'm about to tell you. Okay, so we take the Fermi-Hubbard system, and you add a tilt term. And it's not particularly important that it's Fermi-Hubbard, it can be any band fluid. And we're gonna be in a regime where the tilt strength or the potential difference from one site to the next due to the tilt is of the order of the kinetic energy bandwidth and of the interaction energy. So we're in a strongly tilted, strongly interacting regime.
Is it important that the tilt is along the x direction but not some generic direction?
It's possible to consider it along another direction. Things get a bit more complicated in the hydrodynamics because it kind of breaks some symmetry, and then you have to consider a more complicated hydrodynamics.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so we initially I initially started asking the Bakker lab about this because so Princeton has an experimental project that all PhD students have to do. And I did mine in the Bakker lab building vacuum chambers and electrode systems and stuff. So I knew that it was pretty easy for them to put, you know, they had a Fermi-Hubbard system, and I knew it was pretty easy for them to put a field on it. And I had read some papers on what people were calling Stark MBL, or basically the idea that block oscillating systems in the non-interacting limit would still be localized if you put interactions, turn interactions on. And many body localization, by the way, is a ergodicity breaking mechanism. So I was interested in that and started talking to them about it. And we started, you know, playing around with some data that they got from their experiment. And we actually found that the system is not in this very strong tilt limit where you can talk about an effective Hamiltonian that microscopically conserves dipole moment. It's a more emergent dipole moment conservation that I'll tell you about. So the idea here is just to explore this new regime of strong tilts and strong interactions. Okay, so the experiment and also what we consider in our hydrodynamic model is, you know, basically to initialize a charge density wave in the tilt direction. So the wave vector is in the tilt direction, and, you know, watch it relax. So they have a quantum gas microscope in their lab, and these are, you know, images of the data. And the idea is basically to watch this density relax as a function of time, and also when possible probe the local energy density as well, which I'll tell you about later. Okay, so this is the experiment we're talking about here, just relaxation of density waves in this tilt. Okay, so what happens at early times? So at early times, as you might expect, if you put a cloud of atoms at a finite temperature in a, you know, a constant field or a tilted potential, the cloud will fall down the tilt and locally heat up to near infinite temperature. And by infinite temperature here, I mean, you know, the energy is in the middle of the kinetic energy is in the middle of the band, and the interaction energy is close to the maximum entropy value. Okay, so there's a bounded energy density in this system because it's trapped in the single band of the lattice. So infinite temperature is something you talk about. Okay, so the cloud falls down a little bit and heats up to near infinite temperature. The final global equilibrium is going to be when this density wave relaxes and you get something that's like uniform at infinite temperature. But the density wave relaxing takes time, and that happens at later times. But we can ask, what is the condition for local thermal equilibrium here? And at high enough temperatures, which is where we're at, local thermal equilibrium implies that the slope of the density profile is going to go like the tilt times the temperature. Okay, you can get that prediction by just doing a two-site stat-mech model and seeing that this is the limiting behavior. Intuitively, if you have a finite tilt and a finite temperature, you'll find more particles at a lower potential. Okay, So that yields a prediction for that we can test in the experiment. It predicts that if you find a way of measuring the temperature locally, which at infinite near infinite temperatures, at very high temperatures, this is doable because you can basically measure all of the measure the probability of having a doublon or singlons, and you can back out the temperature from that. Basically, in an atomic limit, it's called. This local thermal equilibrium condition predicts that the charge density profile is going to be 1/4 wavelength out of phase with the temperature profile. That's what this derivative will do, right? It turns a sine into a cosine. And they actually measured this in the lab. So in the green, you can see the density profile. And in the orange, it's the measured temperature profile. And one of the orange curves, the solid orange curve underneath, is a fit to the data. And the dashed orange curve is a prediction from taking this density curve and the condition of local thermal equilibrium and predicting what it should be. So it looks like the system is in local thermal equilibrium from early on, okay? And then the charge density relaxes, and that's what we're interested in for the rest of this talk. But we can watch what the phase shift is between these two waves, the temperature and density wave. And we can see that over time, it actually stays at a quarter wavelength, pi over two, okay? But we're interested in the late time hydrodynamic regime after this local equilibrium is established. Okay, so the density waves in the system are going to relax, something like this form. So you have some density wave. We think that and we'll show that the amplitude decays exponentially in time, and we can basically scan over different wavelengths and plot the decay of this amplitude in time, and for a given tilt strength F, we can extract some effective scaling exponent that tells you, alpha, that tells you how the time scale for relaxation varies with the wavelength. And then we can plot that scaling exponent alpha as a function of tilt. And you can see a crossover from diffusion at small tilts, which is what you would expect, to some so far unexplained subdiffusion at stronger tilts. And this is the main observation of the work, and its explanation is what we'll go into next. Okay, so we can try to construct a hydrodynamic model that explains this observation. So just for simplicity, we're going to work near the global equilibrium, so at very high temperatures and near a uniform density with slight perturbations above that. And the two fluids that are in this hydrodynamic model are the charge density and the non-tilt energy density. So this non-tilt energy density is the energy density from the Fermi-Hubbard terms in the Hamiltonian and not from the tilt term. We'll deal with that separately. And I'm just denoting the entropy density as S here. So we can write down first just our conservation law. So this is conservation of charge. And this is conservation of energy. On the right, there is this source term, because if you send a charge current down the hill, you'll produce, you'll produce energy. Okay, the total energy is conserved, including the tilt. But if we're talking about non-tilt energy, when you send current down the hill, it'll produce non-tilt energy. Okay, and those currents have to be driven by some thermodynamic forces, and these coefficients are difficult to calculate, or we couldn't calculate them from the microscopics, but we can just leave them in the theory. And the thermodynamic forces are really derivable from asking the question, how much does the entropy change when we do something like move some charge from one little coarse-grained pocket to the next without moving any energy, and the so that gives this normal this usual gradient expression basically, and the the corresponding expression for so the corresponding expression for moving charge down the tilt, you have to create energy at that point too. So you get this extra term that couples the tilt into these dynamics. And so basically this system is just a linear system of equations, and you can Fourier transform it or plug in some plane wave ansatz, and you get a decay time for these plane waves, these density waves, as a function of the tilt and the wavelength. And so we can go back and then extract a prediction for this scaling exponent alpha that I mentioned over here that we're plotting in this crossover. We can generate a prediction for that from the theory in a certain limit that's actually parameter free. And that's what we plot here underneath the data. The error, or you know, the width of the line is due to just having to plug in a wave vector k here, you know, which we vary in the experiment. So we plug in some value of k that is characteristic of the experimental system, and plot this prediction as a function of f, and that's what this predicted curve is. And just parameter free, it fits the experiment perfectly. And these coefficients SNN and SEE are just basically obtained from the high temperature expansion of the entropy of the Fermi-Hubbard model. So they're just functions of the hopping and the interaction energy, which we know. Okay, so the punchline is that the tilted system will cross over from diffusive to subdiffusive with this, you know, power four exponent at strong tilts or long wavelengths. As you can see, this crossover is actually a function of k over f and not just f. So k is the wave vector. Okay, so, but I haven't really explained exactly how the subdiffusion comes in. I've just told you that, you know, my collaborators did an experiment. We came up with a hydrodynamic model, and the fit, the agreement was really nice. But in this slide, I want to tell you exactly how the subdiffusion happens. Okay, so we can consider a density wave in space. And by the way, I'm sorry, I haven't mentioned that. I should have mentioned this. I just realized that the system is it's invariant in the direction perpendicular to the tilt. So I've been treating this like a 1D system in the hydrodynamic model. Sorry for not mentioning that earlier. So we can consider this this density wave in the system. And so at regions like this, where you have a gradient of the density, you have a current going downhill. You know, that's what you need to do to relax the system. But if you send a current downhill, it will make heat. Okay. And if you send a current uphill over here, that will need to absorb heat, because you need heat to send current up a potential. But we also have this local equilibrium condition, and that fixes the energy profile to be a quarter wavelength out of phase with the charge density profile. So this energy wave is already fixed by local equilibrium. And you can see that what's happening is that we're making heat in the region where there's already excess heat. Okay, so that's going to slow down the diffusion that would normally happen. And the basic argument is that the total amount of tilt energy in this kind of profile comes from having to move a wavelength's worth of mass up by a wavelength, or over by a wavelength distance. And then, you know, you multiply that by the tilt to get the total tilt energy in this system. That's, you know, F lambda squared, okay? But you need to dissipate that tilt energy, and you can only do that in chunks of size one over the tilt, because, you know, basically that's the size of this lobe here in the energy distribution. because it's a wavelength times wave vector over tilt. So you get 1/tilt. Okay, so the number of chunks that you need to, the number of chunks of tilt energy that you need to dissipate is F squared, your tilt squared, wavelength squared. That's the number of chunks. And they each are going to diffuse in a time that goes like the normal diffusion time, which is wavelength squared over some diffusion constant. Okay. So that reasoning tells you that the density wave takes a whole time, you know, takes a total time like this to decay. And, you know, the basic fourth power subdiffusion comes from the fact that heat diffusion here is the bottleneck in this process. And there's a lambda squared tilt energy that needs to be dissipated. That's where the four powers of wavelength in the subdiffusion law comes from. Okay. And basically that bottleneck of heat diffusion connects like this region with this region. And in an emergent way, it means that you can only send charge downhill when the heat is going to go over and allow the other charge to move uphill. So there's this emergent dipole moment conservation where you get these pairwise transport of charge.
Sorry, by emergent here emergent means that it actually emerges on long wavelengths, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to distinguish this kind of dipole moment conservation from the microscopic, like, kind of dipole moment conservation that would be in like a fracton model. So yeah, it's happening at the hydrodynamic level. It's not happening. There is no effective Hamiltonian that you can write down that works for this system that conserves dipole moment.
So this is by contrast to a case where you had like an extremely strong tilt. In that case, you would have such a symmetry, right? Or effectively.
Yes. Effectively in 1D. In 2D, if you put the tilt along one of the lattice directions, then you have free motion in the other direction. And then I think it gets more complicated. I think that's actually like, these are the kind of questions that you could extend this work with. Like, it's still an unfinished topic, I think, the question of dynamics in strongly tilted systems.
Well, I think as long as you have very strong tilt, you at least have a dipole conservation in that direction, right? Sometimes people call this an emergent symmetry too. That was my confusion. But it's a very different sense of emergent, I think.
Yeah. Right. Does that, did I answer your question? Or?
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. So just to summarize this first part, the punchline is that we basically found a new universal hydrodynamic regime of subdiffusion in systems that are, it doesn't have to be some tilted Fermi-Hubbard system. It's just the key ingredient was that the energy density of the system is bounded. Okay, so it has to be like a band fluid, it has to be restricted to a band. And therefore you get these dynamics where you can only really absorb so much tilt energy into the non-tilt terms of the Hamiltonian locally before you have to do something with it, with that amount, that extra energy. And this effect, comes from the interplay of energy conservation and this external tilted potential. And maybe one way to see this result is that I think it's an interesting example of taking a classical framework and then having the classical framework pushed in kind of new directions when you supply quantum motivated inputs, right? Which would basically be a bounded energy density in a lattice.
So Alan, in the real experiment, what is the size of the band gap?
So I don't know what the size of the band gap is, but it's experimentally it was checked that the system remains in the first band.
Okay.
Yeah. But that is something we worried about at one point. Yeah.
And eventually, so one can ask how many steps you have to go down the hill
until you
can go reach the next band.
Right. That's like the relevant relevant thing to ask, but I think there's also like a matrix element that you have to think about in that process, which decays as well. So it's not super obvious to me that you really have to, it's not super obvious to me when you have to worry about the bands coupling, but in the experiment, we did check they don't in this case.
Mm-hmm. Just want to make sure, suppose you are doing this experiment in a solid, where phonons may be important, and that's it. So basically I want to ask, what's the essential advantage or something in doing this in cold atom?
Well, I think in a solid, achieving a tilt strength that's of order the microscopic energy is not possible, right? I think about like cold atom systems a lot more than I think about like real materials, but I mean transport experiments are done in a weak tilt, a weak field limit, right? Like the right. So I think that the energy scales are so different in materials versus cold atoms that this kind of regime of having the tilts equal to the hopping equal to the interactions is just like not accessible in materials as far as I know.
Uh-huh.
But maybe I haven't thought about that a lot. So maybe that's possible, but I think it's not.
Mm-hmm. But is the coupling to phonon destructive here?
I mean, it would certainly give another place to dump tilt energy into. But I mean, I still think that it would be bounded, you know, a bounded local energy density. Or it could, yeah, it could be. So it's not clear that it would have to be destructive, but definitely it supplies another more degrees of freedom to dump tilt energy into. And that's the whole thing here, is that there's a limited place to dump the tilt energy into. And so you need to like convert tilt energy over into some other form of energy, let that disperse before you can convert more tilt energy into heat, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. I also have a question. So in principle, is having a charge conservation important for you? I mean, in principle,
yeah.
Even if I just have energy conservation, many of the notions you mentioned still seem to make sense, right?
I mean, I think you need a charge conservation here. I mean, I don't really even know what. Yeah, I think it would be very strange if you didn't have charge conservation in such a system, because, you know, what would that mean? It'd mean like particles pop in and out of existence at, you know, at different points that would cost linearly different amounts of energy. It's like having, you know, it's like having electric fields, but not having conserved electric charges. And that seems problematic to me. And I, yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So the next part of the talk is basically loosely connected. And it's connected, like I said, by dipole moment conservation. But here we're going to consider a 1D system where there's really microscopic dipole moment conservation. And you know, this can be realized, as Dominic said, you know, say take a 1D system and have a very strong tilt that's much stronger than any of the local energy scales. And then, you know, you get some effective Hamiltonian that microscopically conserves the dipole moment. And this work was done in collaboration with Vedika Kamani at Stanford and my advisor David. Okay, so a little bit of background, and maybe some of you would prefer these terms. So there were some papers that came out maybe a couple years ago that coined this term of Hilbert space fragmentation and considered dipole conserving Hamiltonians or random circuits. So let's just be concrete here. The paper I'm going to talk about is, you know, this Hamiltonian and this plot are pulled from Pablo Sala and Frank Pullman's paper and others in Pullman's group. So the Hamiltonian is a spin one Hamiltonian, and it has these dipole conserving pair hopping. So you can have a minus one go to or a plus one go to a minus one, and have the other two spins on the right go from zero to one or something like that. So it's like this pair hopping dipole conserving move of range three, and they also considered a range four Hamiltonian like that. Okay, so that if you think about it in terms of particles, it's like this pair hopping transition. And what they found was that if you just look at the connectivity of the Fox states in this system, these constraints are enough to break up that graph, which is normally connected if the system is ergodic, but it breaks that Fox space graph up into exponentially many sectors that are dynamically connected. Now, in the case that you only consider this H3, so a short range pair hopping model, then what they found was that the biggest connected sector of the Fox space, the dimension of it, relative to the symmetry sector it was in. So this is normalizing out the fact that if you have conserved quantities like charge and dipole moment, you have different sectors in your Hamiltonian. So you normalize out that. But the fraction of states in this largest connected sector goes down exponentially with system size. Okay, so you really get that the states are not connected to each other dynamically. And this basically leads to like a localization-like phenomenon. And if you add in the higher range term, they found that the largest connected sector basically contains almost all of the states. That's what these blue stars are, okay? And they called this strong and weak Hilbert space fragmentation because the dynamics or the constraints break up the Hilbert space into these different sectors, or they fragment the Hilbert space in a way that breaks ergodicity or breaks thermalization strongly or weakly if you're talking just about typical initial states. So in this case, this blue star case where most of the states are in the largest sector, most of the states are still connected to each other and the system thermalizes. Unless you pick a special state, the system will thermalize its local observables. And in the other case, it doesn't. Okay. And you can notice that this problem is essentially classical because we're just talking about Fox space configurations and their connectivity under some, definite moves or local transitions. And so that's the angle we're coming at it from for the rest of this talk, is that this is basically a classical problem. And we're going to ask the question of, is it possible that you have a phase transition between these weak and strong, weakly and strongly fragmented, or weakly and strongly thermalizing phases? Okay.
So is it right? Yeah. As far as conserved quantities are concerned, H3 and H4 have exact same conserved quantities, is that right?
Well, they both have charge and dipole moment conservations, but then the Hilbert space breaks up into connected sectors in very different ways. But that breaking up is not easily labeled like a like in the case of a symmetry. So it's like a question of how to label those sectors. But it seems different in character.
But is there some many-body observable in principle that
I think in principle there would be, right? Yeah. And people have written papers trying to come up with actually Pablo Sala and Frank Holman's group have written a paper trying to come up with what they call statistically localized integrals of motion. And so there has been effort in that direction, but it's not like a...
Is it known that there's no local conserved quantities?
I think that if I have it right, I think that the conserved quantities that have been generated in trying to answer this question are quasi-local in some way. So they're not actually, they're quasi-local.
Oh, quasi mean is kind of...
Meaning not, you meaning a slowly decaying tail, yeah.
With Paolo?
I think that's the result, but I would have to go back and check.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so the model that we're gonna consider is just a classical stochastic lattice gas in one dimension. So it has some sites in one dimension, and on each site you can have zero, one, or two particles. So it's like the spin one system, but I'd prefer to talk about particles here. And at each time step, a close packed layer of four site gates acts on this lattice. The gates act totally randomly, but they conserve the charge and dipole moment locally of the particle distribution. Okay, so for instance, here I've drawn, I think, black circles are the before and pink circles are the after. And, these arrows denote the dipole and charge conserving transitions that occur. Okay, and these are this is going to generate the same Hilbert space connectivity as the H3 plus H4 Hamiltonian of the other study that I just told you about. Okay, so just to make sure we have the model straight, right, so these kinetic constraints lead to pair hopping, and you can enumerate all the allowed transitions. There are some locally frozen configurations as well. But one important point is that single particles or single holes, because the system is particle hole symmetric about half filling, they're immobile. So we can think about just, a system that has density, high density, say, and it has a few scattered holes. Those will initially be immobile. And so you might expect a frozen phase up at the edges of the density phase diagram, and a more active phase near half filling. And that is what happens. So we're going to be interested in the dynamics of typical states at a given density and with no dipole moment. So generally the states that we're talking about are uniform density, and we vary the density. Okay, so some terminology that will be useful in the discussion. So we're going to call a site active if at any point during the dynamics, it's changed its occupancy. So if it flips from zero particles on that site to one or to two or something, at any point during the history of evolution, that site forevermore is called active, okay? Because we know it can undergo transitions. And the opposite is called a frozen site. It's a site which has never changed its occupancy from the initial condition. And so this notion of active and frozen depends on what initial state we're simulating, what time we're looking at, and the site. Frozen sites can become active in time, but active sites are always labeled active. They can't become frozen. And one of the key quantities we're going to look at is just the density of frozen sites in the system at long times. That's going to be an order parameter for the frozen phase. And since this system is particle hole symmetric, I'm just going to constrain myself to densities between one and two, or the upper half. So we can just do some direct simulations of this Markov chain, and we can track the density of frozen sites in the system, and also track the charge density. So this is the number density in space of frozen sites, and this is the charge density of the active regions, okay? And because this is just some classical stochastic simulation, we can do large systems and late times. And so in this plot, basically for as I vary the density of the system and the time evolution is given by the green goes from light to dark, you can see that there's a phase, an active phase, where the density of frozen regions goes, or frozen sites goes to zero at long times. So all the sites are active. And then a frozen phase where you get some density of frozen sites, and those partition up the system into active bubbles. And then you can ask, what's the average charge density of those active bubbles? Well, in the active phase, the whole system becomes active. And so it's just the density of the active regions tracks the density of the full system because they're the same thing. But once you hit the frozen phase, you see it, the charge density of the active regions caps out at some critical value of 1.5, which is where the frozen phase starts. So we kind of get this idea that there are some initially active sites in the system, and the dynamics starts running, and the active sites kind of do their dynamics, and they provide like a charge bath to the neighboring frozen sites, and they unfreeze them, and the active bubbles kind of grow until they hit the critical density, and then they stop growing. Okay, so that's the picture that we get from these simulations. And basically the whole picture I want to tell you about, but I'll elaborate. So first we can look in the active phase, again, just running these numerical simulations. And we can look at something like the charge autocorrelation function to see what dynamical exponent the charge dynamics has. And these simulations are just done at half filling in the middle of the active phase, and it's averaged over samples. But basically what you get is that the connected correlation function is a function of time decays like t to the negative 1/4, which implies this subdiffusion law that we found earlier. Okay, so again, we find that in a thermalizing phase, when there's charge and dipole moment conservation, whether it's emergent or microscopic, you get this subdiffusion. Okay. And in the frozen phase, remember I told you this picture about, you have active bubbles and they're expanding into the frozen regions. So we can try to just consider what happens in an isolated active bubble like that. That's just like the basic element of the frozen phase. And the toy system we're going to consider is just a block of ones, so that's half filled, embedded in some infinite sea of fully filled sites. So the fully filled sites are by default frozen because they can't flip under charge and dipole moment conservation. And the half-filled region is going to be active from the start. And this, so this low-density active region will provide a charge bath to these frozen regions. And so the active region will expand. And I'm defining the active region as, all the sites that have been labeled as active by some time t, which means that they have flipped their configuration at some point. And so you can just track, the density of this active bubble in time as it expands and thermalizes or unfreezes, maybe is a better term, unfreezes some of the frozen sites. And we see that it, this active bubble approaches, again, this critical density of 1.5. And from left to right here, the curves are going up in the size of the initial bubble from 12 to 48. Okay. And so as the bubble gets larger, it takes longer to grow to its eventual final size and hit the critical density. So it actually doubles in size exactly and becomes critical. And this is a basic element of the frozen phase. But basically, what we think happens is that these bubbles, isolated bubbles, grow and merge, and they stop growing when they hit their critical value, critical density. And we can try to extract a dynamical scaling exponent from this data by just asking, you know, how much time does it take for this bubble to reach its final critical density? And then as a function of the length, we can look at that critical, the length of the bubble, we can look at the critical exponent and try to see, you know, does it level off as a function of the size, or is it still drifting? Like, can we actually say what value it takes? So we would say it's around 7 or 8, but we don't know if it continues drifting, and we can't simulate larger sizes to convergence. And we also were not able to analytically predict what the exponent should be. Okay, so that's the best we have for that for now. But it's obviously the exponent's going to be greater than 4, because it's 4 in the active phase for the subdiffusion. So you'd expect that at the critical point, it's slower. So it's okay. It's slower. It's, you know, the exponent is 7. It's not particularly, we don't have any particular insights for that, unfortunately, right now. Okay, but what I've described to you is a pretty simple picture about active regions embedded in a frozen system, and they grow until they reach critical density. So you can kind of make an approximate model where the input is some like huge charge configuration, and we identify some initially active regions, and then we don't explicitly so we sample this initial charge configuration, but we don't explicitly evolve it. We just identify the boundaries between active and frozen, and we allow those boundaries to expand as long as the charge density within them remains below the critical density. And I can tell you exactly how we did it, but I don't think it's that important. Basically what it ends up yielding is you run it to convergence, and in the frozen phase, it gives you like a pattern of active bubbles in a system that are partitioned by little frozen regions. Okay, and we can look at what is the distribution of active block lengths, say in the frozen phase and at the critical point. And we have an analytic argument for all of these results, but I think it's easier to just show pictures. So, you can histogram these block length sizes, and we find that at the critical point it approaches, this power law distribution. And you can see that over on the right. This is the length of the active bubbles in the system. And this is just the probability. And this is the power law that I'm talking about. And as you go from light blue to dark blue, you're approaching the critical density. And then we can ask, what is the correlation length? And the correlation length here, we just define basically by a statistic that pulls out the length scale at which this curve deviates from the power law. And we find that numerically this fits really well with the correlation length critical exponent nu is 2. So the critical exponent diverges like 1 over the difference of density from the critical density to the power of 2. And if we scale the lengths of the active blocks in this distribution with that critical exponent nu equals 2, we get this nice collapse of the distribution as well. So it seems like like we have it right. And we can also make some analytic arguments for all of these exponents. And the order parameter exponent is just, how does the critical density, or how does the spatial density of frozen sites onset at the critical point, and it onsets linearly. So this plot on the left here really does have a kink of two lines meeting. That's what beta equals 1 means. Okay, so in that part of the talk, I basically just told you about this research on Hilbert space fragmentation and told you about a system that we considered with microscopic charge and dipole moment conservation that has a subdiffusion in an active phase, and it also has this freezing phase transition to a frozen phase as a function of density. And hopefully I conveyed a simple understanding of what's going on in this in the frozen phase and in this transition, just by considering simple things like isolated active bubbles and some simple numerical simulations of those things. And overall, hopefully in this talk, I conveyed that emergent or microscopic dipole moment conservation, of the charge distribution in a system can lead to interesting, dynamical crossovers, phases, and also critical points. So I think that's it. I'm happy to take questions. And I also have a couple slides on other work if anyone else wants to talk about those, but I'm pretty tight on time. So thanks.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Let me ask, so in your second part, so you labeled a site that has ever changed its occupation number in the history as active, right?
Yeah.
But in reality, some site may flip once, but then never change the density.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there are kind of like, you can worry that notion of frozen and active sites is like an imperfect tool. And I agree that that there are some cases that where, for instance, you can have a configuration that flips between two different, like a little region that flips between two different configurations, and like is that thermal? Like, I don't know. It's like a two site little bubble, right?
Yeah.
But those are generally exceptions, like rare exceptions. That's not what most of the system is doing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another way to think of like frozen versus active is in this picture of Hilbert space fragmentation, and if you have a connected sector of states that can all get to each other via the dynamics, if you say a site is frozen, then what that means is all the states in that sector connected to the initial state have the same value of charge on that site. That's like another way of saying it. And we did some numerics on small systems where you can exactly build all these sectors. And, we used other measures of trying to detect this fragment, this transition from weak to strong Hilbert space fragmentation. And we saw that in small systems, although the numerics is imperfect, for small systems and not, there's no sharp transition. We saw that basically the crossover in those small systems was at the same location, whether you talk about frozen versus active site density, or you talk about some other measures of fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Tarun?
Thank you for a very nice talk. I had a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. One question was about the contrast between this H3 and H3 plus H4. So when you have both terms, is it true that you still had exponentially many sectors, although the larger mm-hmm. sector was almost same size as the symmetry sector? My question is that if I keep the symmetry same, some dipole moment conservation and charge conservation, and allow a most generic short range system with those symmetries. So I don't know, H3 plus H4 plus, I don't know, HN, something like that, where N is mm-hmm. not, N does not go to infinity as system size, N is kept finite. Do you expect that eventually you will not have any, you won't have anything else except but the symmetry sectors?
Right. Okay. Exactly. Like this critical point that I'm talking about, if you add longer range gates, the critical point moves up towards the extremal density. So the active phase enlarges as you allow longer range gates. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that in a real system, like if you imposed effective dipole moment conservation by putting like a strong field on a charge conserving system, then what happens is in the effective Hamiltonian, the longer range terms get suppressed, you know, exponentially in the range. Mm-hmm. So I think what would happen is the system would, you know, always eventually thermalize or be active, but the thermalization time, you know, you'd have a phase where the thermalization time is not very sensitive to the density. That would be like the active phase here. And then the frozen phase here would generalize into a phase whose thermalization time depends very strongly on the density.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you'd effectively like, you'd have to go to the active phase of the range N terms mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to thermalize, and those would be suppressed exponentially in N. And so, and this kind of leads also to questions of like, can we realize the something like this transition experimentally? And yeah.
Can I ask one more question about, so if I go back to your first part, if I now keep on increasing that tilt, let's consider maybe consider a 1D system. Actually, you don't have to even go to any slides, but just the,
okay.
If you were a 1D system, we would have talked about the stark localization.
Yeah.
So you believe if you just take your model and so they exist some critical tilt above which you go from subdiffusion to no diffusion. Is that your understanding?
Right. And even that critical point may, you know, it's unclear to me how that drifts or if that, I think it mm-hmm. probably drifts. I think it's something like to me that kind of, when I think about the Stark MBL systems, it makes me, you know, think about like Floquet heating, mm-hmm. like a static version of Floquet heating, but mm-hmm. the analogous problem, like if you just do the Pyrrhos substitution and you turn it into a Floquet system, the tilted mm-hmm. system, and then you just think about it in terms of Floquet heating, mm-hmm. the tricky thing is that the zeroth order Floquet Hamiltonian in those systems mm-hmm. is not chaotic. It's just the interaction term.
Right.
And that's very different from normal Floquet heating that people have studied. And I really don't know like if heating ever happens or.
Please go. Yeah. I was just saying,
no, that's basically it.
Uh-huh. But is it fair to say, so it is not yet known whether Stark localization occurs at a finite tilt, finite meaning non-infinite tilt. Is that fair to say? Or
in an infinite system. I would say that, but you know, this is something I've paid attention to, but you know, haven't since mm-hmm. these two papers haven't come back to really intensely work on that. Yeah, like a question is like, does the tilt strength scale, you know, does the critical tilt strength scale with system size in, you know, some way? Yeah. Mm-hmm. People are asking these questions about MBL as well. And there's this, all this stuff,
right?
You know, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Also, just if I have like 1 minute, I wanted to also just mention that there were a couple papers that were related and like follow either came out at the same time as this second one, and also you know, just followed up on it. They're like surrounding the term fracton hydrodynamics by Rahul Namkishore and Andrew Lucas and also Frank Paulman's team. So there are some related papers by those guys as well.
Can you give us a quick tour of the other stuff, other works?
Yeah. Yeah, so earlier this year, I had a paper on MBL in, on what are called avalanches in MBL systems and also rare many-body resonances in MBL systems. The basic thing that we did was, try to make a distinction between the breakdown of MBL in very large systems and the breakdown of MBL in small systems, and try to make a distinction between the mechanisms that drive those two things. And in small systems, we found these very broad distributions of essentially effective matrix elements that cause different types of, or that, that cause resonances. And because the distribution is so broad, different types of resonances are caused by different statistics of that distribution. And since the distribution is broad, the onset of those different kinds of resonances is actually well separated in finite systems. And that's what these like landmarks are that we're drawing. So that's roughly what we did in that. I also have a couple works on RG approaches to try to understand the MBL phase transition in the asymptotic, very, very large system, very long time, totally experimentally inaccessible regime. Then recently, just in November, we came out with a paper basically repurposing tensor processing units, which are like specialized processors for machine learning, but repurposing them for simulations of like quantum many-body systems. And the topic we benchmarked on was like the Floquet heating problem, which can be difficult because you don't have a lot of dynamical regime to see the resulting exponentially slow thermalization that happens in Floquet systems that are driven at high frequencies. Yeah. So that's those are the other works. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Arlan.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for
Okay. Great
for listening.
Thank you for the nice talk.